Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is C. Steen Duckworth, and you can call in or Skype into this program by calling 1-646-668-2928 #1. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, C. Steen Duckworth.
Welcome, everyone, to our program today, A Taste of Ink Live. And let me tell you, Arizona is starting to cool down. Yay! After going through some harrowing 117 degrees and even higher humidity. Well, today I want to get started with some announcements. The Book Fest of Los Angeles is happening again for the fall, October the 24th and 25th. We are so happy to be part of the Book Fest this year. And if you haven't been to their website to sign up and register for all the little gifts that you're going to get and meeting the great authors that are going to be presented there this particular fall, their website is thebookfest.com. And go in there and register. You're going to get so much information, especially if you're an up-and-coming author or you're an author and want to see, you know, who's out there, what events that you could probably participate in. The next announcement we have is that our author's retreat in Ireland is back on. Yay! It's going to be in May of 2022. And if you'd like to know more information about that, go to the website at verticalalliance.com and go to the tab that says Creative Ventures. Our facilitator this year is going to be Jackie Shelton Green. She is the new North Carolina Poet Laureate. And so we're honored to have her facilitating for us this year. We'll be in Tullamore, Ireland, which is about an hour outside of Dublin. And this is a retreat for writers. Okay. It's going to be some great relaxing adventure, meeting great individuals and other authors there in Ireland. So if you go to the website, you can see more information about how to become a part. So today, our guest is Sarah Dickinson. Sarah has a book called Silver Spoons, One Journey Through Addiction. It's a dark and harrowing journey with two young lovers who are struggling with drug addiction and rehab. And it also gives you an in-depth look at the aspects of the opiate crisis. And I will say to you, this book is honest, it's real, and it really is honest about addiction and recovery and about a relationship. Sarah is a lifelong resident of upstate New York, and she is a devoted wife and mom. She is the author, and she has two amazing daughters and three equally amazing rescue dogs. Currently, she is pursuing her master's degree when she isn't doing other things that she enjoys, like comic books, blogging, and long weekend adventures. Sound like my type of person. I love those long weekend adventures. So, everyone, I'd like you to welcome Sarah Dickinson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, great. I'm great. It's great to have you on. I haven't had someone with a book that really goes through a relationship that's going through addiction and recovery and everything that goes with that. So I'm really glad to have you on. I'm glad to have read your book, which was, and I will say, it's really honest, everybody. If you are looking for a book with just all the flowery stuff, you're not going to get it with Sarah's book. You're going to get a real book. It's a great read. And I hope that after today's interview that you'll go out and buy it. It is available at Amazon as well. So, Sarah, give me a little bit more background about yourself during the time that before you started writing Silver Spoons.
Well, the book was inspired by a relationship that I had. It was really not the romantic relationship that is portrayed in the book. Obviously, it's fiction, but it did inspire it. It was just a very, very, like, one of those friends that their family, one of those kind of people that, like, they're just as much as, you know, your siblings and all that kind of stuff. And
right.
He was a veteran. He was a veteran in Afghanistan, and he was in a Humvee that got blown up, and he had PTSD and traumatic brain injury and all sorts of, you know, physical ailments, and
right.
His treatment was just put you on, we're going to give you painkillers. That was his treatment. We're going to put you on painkillers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of veterans out there that end up with, you know, serious drug problems because of the fact of that's their treatment is to put them on painkillers. And then there's just that, you know, mentality of we're strong, we're tough, you know, and the shame that comes in with, you know, addiction that they don't really seek a lot of help. And
right.
he became addicted to painkillers, which are, you know, just it's really just synthetic heroin,
right?
You know, Percocet, and it's all man-made heroin. And he became addicted, and then he couldn't afford it because he'd been taking them for too long, and he definitely developed addiction. And he switched to heroin, and it was I was just a completely naive person. I knew nothing about addiction. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my experience with drugs was basically, like, you go to a party and some people do some stuff. You know, maybe they smoke a little weed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they drink a little too much.
Right.
But it was never anything hard, and it was never people that had serious problems. So I was very naive. And, you know, he also, I don't know how, like, he did have that sort of what you expect with somebody who was in the military, that very respectful.
Okay.
He was not the typical addict in the way that he did not steal from you. He did not, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. He didn't really do that. So when he would say, oh, they're adjusting my meds for this, or, oh, they're adjusting, I was very believing of that. Like, why would he lie?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's on meds for, you know, this, and this. And then before I knew it, I had kind of gotten sucked into his addiction and his problems. And I was there when he hit his bottom. And then I was there when he went to the VA. And, you know, the VA put him in, you know, their rehab program, which they do have some wonderful rehab programs. The problem is not a lot of people use them. I was just there. And so there are a lot of events in the book that very much happened almost word for word. And then there are a lot of events in the book that are completely and totally made up because it wasn't really his story or his life.
Right.
So it was inspired by it. So there were definitely some, you know, some in-betweens for good fiction. And that fiction came from someplace specific, which I think lent my ability to make sure that it was as honest as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one of the biggest things is when I went to write the book when he was in recovery, I went to AA for a year.
Oh, okay. All right.
I went to meetings. I worked the steps. You know, everybody knew why I was there. I was there. You know, they knew I was there, you know, researching for this book. And there are stories that are in there that are from people that I spoke to that kind of wanted, mm-hmm. you know, their story heard as well. But, yeah, and there were meetings, obviously, that I wasn't allowed because they have closed meetings where you have to be, you know, you have to be an addict to in recovery to attend. But there
right.
was somebody who there was a gentleman there who became my sponsor, but you know, even though he mm-hmm. knew, but he helped me go through the steps, understand the steps, understand the points of the steps, and all of that.
Why did you call it Silver Spoons? I was thinking when I saw the title, give me a little bit of a glimpse. But why did you title it Silver Spoons? One's journey through addiction.
Well, I started basically because you need a spoon to mix heroin.
Right. Okay. All right.
But also because of the fact that he was not the type of person, and that's the main point of this is when most people like myself when I met him, when I hear somebody's a heroin addict, you picture somebody who has a lifetime of addiction. A lifetime
right.
of, you know, using and abusing
mm-hmm.
drugs, and they're at their bottom. And that's not today's heroin addict. Today's heroin addict is in their 20s. They tend to be
mm-hmm.
upper middle class.
Mm, okay.
They tend to be upper middle class. There are a lot of military veterans that end up with addiction problems. There are a lot of
mm-hmm.
college kids who end up with, because of the ease that we can obtain prescription strength heroin, and
mm-hmm.
it does not
mm-hmm.
take much. I do believe it only takes about 2 or 3 weeks of using them to physically
yes.
become addicted.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, it's interesting that you how you describe it, because you're correct in how you describe it. I know that when I was going to college, there were individuals that were actually snorting heroin, and
right.
without a clue at how addictive it can become when you're snorting it, going through the respiratory system. But you're also right about the average person you meet on the street. I mean, it could be someone working in a corporate office, or anyone can have an addiction today, and you would not know it. You are, you know, it's not like growing up and you see the addict, you know, in the alley or anything like that. So you're right about that. So I see the relation between your title and what you're talking about. So it's very easy for people to not think that you're an addict.
Right, and most people don't realize. You know, kind of that adage of you don't know what other people are going through based on
right.
what they look like. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that was a lot of where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I also really liked, I don't want to give away your book because I like people to go out and get the book and you know, after they listen to the interview. But I loved how you had the letters. That part made it seem very real.
Yes, I've gotten quite a bit of feedback on that the letters, probably more than anything else, was what really made a lot of people feel for and have
yeah.
a degree of empathy for
mm-hmm.
the characters. Because there's
yes.
a lot of ways that you read what happens, and it's like they're not likable, really. They're not likable
mm-hmm.
characters. You know,
mm-hmm.
and most people, when you hear somebody is an addict, you think of those unlikable qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
those stereotypes are what come to mind, are those unlikable qualities. And it
mm-hmm.
makes
okay.
people very unsympathetic and very
mm-hmm.
uncaring for people who are struggling with addiction. So
mm-hmm.
the letters really added that thing of, this could be my brother, This could be my sister. Mm-hmm. This could be my coworker.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so, yeah, pretty proud of that, that people seem, it resonates with people on that level.
Yeah, because, and you're right, because I know that we volunteer for a few organizations, but I remember when my cousin got addicted to crack, and you would have never thought that he would be that type of person, but I do remember how it was so shocking that when he got picked up by the police a few times, because everybody knew the family, so it was kind of like, why are you out here? You know, why are you doing this?
Right.
So, yeah, I do understand, you know, that aspect too. So, like, when you were writing this book, though, who were you writing it to? Who did you want to be able to see the insides of this book and what was going on?
Basically, I wrote it for myself is how it started.
Okay.
I wrote it as mm-hmm. a way to process the situation that I had gone through with my friend.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
how it started. But then I wrote it for, it started out being for other people that were like me that wanted to be supportive and wanted to help, but we had no idea what we were doing. And
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways, us trying to be helpful ended up being more hurtful because we
mm-hmm.
weren't being supportive, we were being enabling. And I wanted to write it for people like me, but then I also wanted to write it for people like my friend who, on the other side of their addiction, they can, you know, when they get to the other side, they can see, I guess, how valued they are, because a lot of people lose support and family and friends when they finally do get clean. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted them to, you know, people who were suffering through addiction to understand what really went into and the amount of love and support and care that of how much we value that person goes into trying to be there for them, you know, so
mm-hmm.
they don't feel like they were totally, you know, there's probably some pain that they're covering up from things that did go bad, but there are people who have their best interests and who love them for them at heart,
mm-hmm.
so it kind of ended
right.
up being for them too.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that hard? I know you know, doing your research, you were in going through the AA program. Isn't it very hard though for when they hit rock bottom and make that first step? Isn't it very hard for the people that care about them to really be a part? Because from what I understand. From my understanding, is you can't do anything with someone that has an addiction until they hit rock bottom, but they have to initially make their own choice first.
I mean, yes. Yes, you can't convince. Addiction is a self-diagnosed disease, and they're not going
mm-hmm.
to get help until they know that they need help, and
mm-hmm.
you can't do it for them. And also, like, it is the one disclaimer about my book is that it is not recommended that you go through recovery with a partner. It is very much recommended
okay.
that you do it solo. I mean, obviously,
mm-hmm.
if you've been married for 20 years and your husband finally goes to rehab, they're not going to tell you to get a divorce.
Right, right.
But, you know, most of the time it is recommended that you do it solo because it's a very selfish process. You have to work on yourself.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
you are not very
mm-hmm.
giving
mm-hmm.
to other people. So, but there was, you know, there are people who go through it together and try to support each other. So.
Well, I know when you were doing the research, what type of emotions did you go through? Because being able to, you know, be in the program, I'm sure you saw a lot of emotions from the effect of addiction and then trying to get detoxed. What type of emotions
right. well,
did you see?
Every type of emotion, honestly. About 80% of people who are in recovery dealing with a, you know, an addiction disorder tend to have
mm-hmm.
some other mental health disorder as well,
oh,
whether it's
okay.
anxiety, whether it's depression, whether it is trauma. They tend to have, like
mm-hmm.
people, nobody wakes up and decides, I want to be a raging alcoholic. Nobody wakes up
mm-hmm.
and says, I can't wait to be a drug addict. Like, they
mm-hmm.
usually... I mean, yes, there are some people who believe that something is just triggered and that, you know, that people who are addicts have a physical predisposition to be addicted, but most of them have some sort of emotional or psychological mental disorder that they're trying to self-treat. And so you see, but you see everything. You know, you have people who have destroyed their lives. They've destroyed other people's lives. They've, you know, they've done things that they never thought they would be capable of. And a lot of people feel like they deserve, like, our society does not have a lot of compassion for people who are addicts. And a lot of people who are suffering from addiction feel that that's deserved. Like, they understand why, because they don't love themselves. And the program helps them hold themselves accountable and learn to love themselves again and see that they do deserve the same, you know, respect, and they do deserve empathy, and they do deserve a second chance kind of thing. So you see every emotion, and then, you know, you feel some, you know, yourself. Because the honest truth is every single human being that is walking this planet has done something, at least one, that you would do anything to hide. It is your shame. It is your in the closet. You are the villain in somebody else's story. Every single human has that in common. The difference between someone suffering from addiction and someone not is that people who are suffering from addiction, everybody knows theirs. Everybody knows their horrible thing that they did, and they hold themselves accountable and try to make amends for that, where most of us hide it, and we don't even get honest with ourselves about it, let alone other people. So that's the one thing I learned.
In a relationship, when one person is an addict, do you think that sometimes the spouse becomes a huge enabler, even though they think they're helping, but they're actually being more of an enabler?
Another thing that I learned is if you are in any sort of functioning relationship with somebody who is suffering from addiction, you are an enabler.
Okay.
Because you are maintaining a relationship while they are in the throes of their addiction. That it's basically impossible to have a relationship with an addict and not be enabling them. It's not until you say, until you do this, we can't do this kind of situation. Because it's incredibly, you know, you might know, okay, they don't have any money, and even if I give them $5, I just want them to get something to eat. But you know that they're probably not going to use it for food.
Right.
If you give them a place to stay or you give them this, you're thinking, I just want them to be safe, but you're giving them an excuse to justify, you know, to keep doing what they're doing. That somebody will take me in and somebody will. So, I mean, yeah, that the most healthiest thing that you can do for someone who's suffering from addiction is to say, I will be here for you when you decide to get clean. I will be here for you when, you know, you take that first step.
So essentially give them a lifeline, but don't, but without being an enabler. Okay.
Yes.
So one of the things that I was interested in is that when we talk about the opiate addiction, do you think that that a lot of this opiate addiction really is where, you know, health individuals, doctors, didn't really foresee this coming when they started prescribing that, or just some doctors just were very irresponsible? Because it sounds like that even though you're treating someone's pain, that it makes sense to kind of get to the bottom of the pain and see if there's, you know, a mental way to help someone go through that pain before just without just saying, well, you know, this is going to help with the pain and that's it.
Right. And it's a mixed bag. I mean, unfortunately, our healthcare system, like many of our systems, are very, very flawed, and they have their benefits and they have their their negatives, and they have their well-meaning people, and then you have the people who are looking to make a buck. And, you know, so it's hard to tell. I think the majority of doctors
mm-hmm.
just want to be there, do their best by their patient and to make their patient
right.
not suffer. But the bigger
right.
problem outside of the healthcare situation is just our societal norms, you know,
mm-hmm.
the things that we as a society have accepted and we take them to be average. And we've become, our society has become a nation of pill poppers who we do not want to feel any discomfort or ailment. We do not want to deal with, you know, a sore this or a sore that or a sore that. So we go to the doctor, but we also know how easy it is to go to the doctor and tell the doctor we're in pain, and the doctor will, you know, I mean, when it's getting better now, but like at that time,
right.
yeah, that's exactly what would happen. And doctors were overextended, overworked, you know, and
mm-hmm.
most doctors have an average of 15 minutes per patient,
right.
and they can see hundreds of patients in a day. And so
mm-hmm.
they very much need to assess your pain and then try to, you know, make sure it's manageable and you can function, and then, you know, before another appointment is scheduled. So I don't think a lot of doctors realize how it was. I don't think a lot
mm-hmm.
of doctors considered it being like, this is just, you know, lab-made heroin. I don't think doctors thought of it that way. I thought
right,
they just
right.
looked at it as this is another tool in helping
mm-hmm,
our patients
help.
Live,
right.
you know. But, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was the occasional person in there going, I'm going to make so much money, and who cares, because it's still a healthcare system. So.
Right, right. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, this relationship in your book, what was writing about the recovery like? Because I would think that, you know, even though, you know, like you said before, some individuals, once they start going through detox and going through rehab, they start, the other issues that they're covering come out. And I'm thinking then, how could that affect your relationship? You come home from, you know, going through everything and you're recovered. I'm sure there's probably some things that can be hard to go just right back into a relationship.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure as well. And not just a relationship, but day to day. I mean, a lot of people who are suffering from addiction have been on autopilot, essentially,
mm-hmm.
for a very long time.
Okay.
And they don't
mm-hmm.
know how to deal with the smallest of stressors without using
mm-hmm.
their drug of choice. They don't know how to handle,
mm-hmm.
you know, that super bad day that most of us are like, oh, I just want to go home and have like a hot bath and a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
They don't
mm-hmm.
have the option of the glass of wine, but they also, they haven't dealt with super bad days on that level, and it could be for
right.
years. So they have to
mm-hmm.
essentially learn how and develop an entirely new coping system. And
mm-hmm,
they have to change
mm-hmm.
the coping, you know, the mentality that they had for their coping system beforehand, because their instinct is going to be, well, I can get stoned. Well, I can get drunk. And
right.
so all of what they did doesn't work. So,
mm-hmm.
and that was the part that I tried to be the most, I don't want to say challenging, but it was a little bit more sensitive in trying to
right.
write about
mm-hmm.
the recovery process, because
right.
unfortunately when it comes to addiction, we have a million and one books and movies about a drug addict, and it's all the same
right.
narrative
mm-hmm.
where here's this person, they're an addict, and look at all these horrible, horrible things that they've done, and then they're
mm-hmm.
going to go to rehab, and that's awesome. And that's where the story ends. The story never tells us how long rehab is, how hard rehab is, and all of the things that go, you know what I mean? Like, they essentially end the story at the real beginning of it, and they kind of make
right.
a stereotype about addicts being unworthy people, you know?
Right,
like,
because you're absolutely right about that, because I've been to I went to a meeting once with my mom, and it wasn't for alcohol addiction, but it was for weight loss. And the interesting thing is that almost everyone there had started with another addiction. I mean, from alcohol to cigarettes to food, essentially, okay? And so what I was thinking, and you're, you know, because you're right, I was thinking that when they have that great fairy tale at the end that they always show on TV, you essentially come out having to create a new life. I mean, there's some parts of your life that you bring with you, but you really are creating a new life. So are they coming out with the tools to create that new life?
Right. And it's a process. It's not a one and done, like, hey, you're in rehab for 30 days, and here's everything you need to be the best you. Go do it. It's a process, and it's a painful process that involves a lot of honesty. And I think that's the part that, you know what, after I've never had an addiction. I've never had an addiction. I don't drink. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school and we had, you know, we drank and we, you know, smoke weed and all that stuff. Yeah, I walked away from it. Like when it was time to walk away, I walked away from it. And so I've never had an addiction. And after a year of going to meetings, I can tell you right now, everybody would benefit and your life would be better if you went to an AA meeting. The way that the honesty that they live their life and the way that they teach people how to hold themselves accountable, and it's amazing, quite frankly. Like, and I don't think most people understand the battle and the struggle that is of addiction that's added to that, you know, as they go in. So you have people who essentially society is saying, well, you're useless and you're worthless, living a life that's more honest and holding themselves to account more than the people who are telling them that they're worthless. And to be very honest, people who are dealing with addiction, they're warriors. Like, I'm not even going to put it any other way. They are warriors, and every day they fight to be the best person they can be for themselves and for the people that they love. And they do it with less tools than most of us have, and they do it with a lot less support from people who are not going through addiction. So
that's very true. That's very true. We work with homeless people at the place where I volunteer, and it's, you know, when you listen to the story, it's very sad when I see how the general public treats homelessness. Because the stories, it's like if you just sit and listen to the story, you know, and I always say that all of us could actually be in that place. When you said, you know, like, and I know what you mean when growing up. I mean, we grew up in an era where, you know, you tried drugs, okay? So it was just, you know, we're at a party and try drugs. But I understand when you said walk away. I mean, I walked away and I was kind of like, you know, my reason for walking away was kind of like, you know what, I can't see myself trying to find money to support this habit, you know.
Right.
And I was like, the best thing for me to do is walk away and just forget that I ever, you know, that I ever tried this, you know. So, and
I
really,
walked away as soon as it stopped being fun.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, true. And it's funny, me and my daughter had a conversation right there, and she goes, Mom, she goes, honestly, she goes, you're such a control person. I just don't see you like that. And I was like, you're probably right. I have to have some, you know, have to have some level of control in my life. So that's probably something that I would not get involved in. But it is painfully honest. It's even when you're, you know, talking about addictions or any of these things with even with your kids, and you went through an era where, you know, really wasn't a huge thing back then, but, you know, everybody tried it or tried it once or something, or you were at a party where everybody was doing it, and, you know, a lot of people walked away, you know, but it's still something that you don't really want to be honest about either, okay? Just the huge judgment that some people put on people. It's hard to be honest. So going through addiction and being honest with your spouse and, you know, those are like a bunch of things that I would think are just really, really painful to have to deal with, you know, to go through recovery.
Right. Especially, too, considering what I said before, where most of us, our horrible thing that we did that we hide from everybody, when you're going through addiction, everybody who you know knows your horrible thing. They know that
mm-hmm.
thing. I'm sorry. I got like a little I got a little fuzzy in my throat.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm sorry. But that mm-hmm. horrible thing that they did, everybody knows it. And you don't know
mm-hmm.
when it's going to be. I mean, you're going to assume that you're being judged for it, but you don't know when you're going to have it thrown in your face. You don't know when that's going
mm-hmm.
to be used as a reason to keep you from something. Whereas the
mm-hmm.
rest of us, well, we just get to pretend that that horrible thing that we did, that never happened. That never happened, or it didn't happen that way, or we really weren't that involved in it. And that's
right.
something that someone
right.
going through addiction doesn't have the luxury. Everybody
mm-hmm.
that they know
mm-hmm.
knows what they did.
mm-hmm.
So,
well, as I said, it's a beautifully written book.
Thank you.
Love the aspect of it. Yeah, I love the aspect of it coming from, you know, a really, you know, from a relationship aspect. I love the fact that, you know, you could see how the relationship is in the letters. I think the letters are so important because I think the letters kind of give you an ideal of what's really going on. And it's probably what people probably, you know, when you're in a relationship, you know, you're thinking about all this. It's kind of, you know, gets kind of deep. But I was like, wow, that's actually how I would think. You know, that's actually how, you know, I would think about what person that I care about. And some of the things that were said, and I really enjoyed reading the book from that aspect. But I wanted to say too, because you write blogs, and also I read one of the articles that you wrote, and I was want to talk to you a little bit about this in the article. Why, you know, one of the article I saw conflicting life goals, and I wanted to know how does a woman that or man get involved with someone? Do they knowingly know they're an addict when they first start dating, or do they see all the other aspects and not that there might be some other issue here?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think, like, personally,
mm-hmm.
like, obviously, we weren't dating, but he was my friend, and like, I thought we were almost, like, best friends, and it was 3 years before I knew that he had an issue.
Uh-huh.
You know,
okay.
Because obviously he was in the military, and I just brushed everything off.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing is when it comes, like I said before, about societal norms,
yes.
I think a lot
mm-hmm.
of people misread red flags as something else. I think they misread
mm-hmm.
red flags as being butterflies. They
yeah.
misread them as
mm-hmm.
being a challenge. And I think
mm-hmm.
people are so afraid of offending people that
mm-hmm.
we don't ask questions because we don't want to be perceived a certain way. So we kind of let things
mm-hmm.
go at first because we just don't want to be looked at one way or another. I think
mm-hmm.
that I think a lot of, there are also people like me who are just naive and don't know, like, we don't know what red flags to be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, so I think it's a lot of different things that can lead into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things, and it's actually quite funny because one of the negative critiques that I've heard the most about my book is that it seemed like he seemed too idyllic. He seemed too, like, people don't talk like that. Like, it was overly romantic. It was this. It was that. And I'm going to tell you right now, that's exactly how he was in real life. He was.
Right,
that,
right.
That's how he spoke. That's how he operated. That's how he, I mean, I'm talking everybody. Like, he would go, you could go to the mall. I once watched
uh-huh.
him ask a woman who must have been in her 60s to dance
uh-huh.
with him in the aisle
mm-hmm.
of the store.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And made her blush and made her, and that's how he was. And, you know, people have been like, well, that's so unrealistic. And I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you. That's how he was. But the part about it is that was also part of his manipulation tool.
Ah,
in the throes
okay.
of his addiction was that charming, romantic, like, he was almost so charming. How could you think this guy can't handle what he's, like, how could you think he's sneaky? He's so charming. Like,
right.
But that's how he was. And it was definitely, as I, you know, the more that I knew him, the more charm he layered on, the more he was about to, the more he was hiding from you,
yes.
or the more he, something based on how charming
right.
he was. Because his charm and his romantic streak was his manipulation. And I saw it not just with myself, but I saw it with other people. And, but it's very funny because people are like, oh, their relationship was so idyllic and it was so this, and people aren't really like that. And it's like, oh, no, he was. No, he was. So.
Yeah, and I totally get that because I have a friend who's he's like that. and it's funny because people really look up to him and, you know, people come to him for advice, and I mean, he's really good. I mean, he's really, really smart. Okay, and you know, sometimes I mean, he was very honest when I first met him about his addiction. But he was kind of like, I was like, oh, you're so super intelligent. You know, I mean, everybody in the street calls him the Pope of Camelback because it's kind of like that. But I totally get what you're saying because you can't help but really like him, you know. You can't help but ask his advice because you know he's super smart, you know. So it's really, but he's, you know, he doesn't, you know, he's, you know, he's very honest about his drug use, and you know, and he's very honest about that he's not ready. You know, so I'm like, okay, well, I get that, you know, but it's hard to sometimes see them in the throes of the drug, and not say anything.
And
you know,
it's actually very funny because once he, you know, once he became clean, he was still charming and he was still thin, but not as much. When he didn't need to dip into that bag to get a favor out of you or to get a, you know, get your help with just something. He was still definitely charming and he was all sweet and all that stuff, but it was not to a degree that could make you melt, you know, and I'm talking about like, just like that non-sexual way that you can melt with someone, just like, oh my God, they're just Why can't my husband be like that? That kind of melt, like that swoony. And he just had that like ability to make you not just to say it, like. And it's very funny too because I live in New York, so a man walking around acknowledging every woman as "How are you, beautiful?" is usually seen as condescending. It's not 1,000% appreciated here. And he'd get away with it because he would make you believe he thought you were beautiful.
Okay.
He addressed everybody as beautiful. Like.
Okay.
Variation of it, but like he addressed. Like we went to a diner once, and we were walking, and there was a woman who I would say she was somewhere in her late 60s, early 70s, and she was in the booth next to us with family, friends, something like that. And he spilled something, and he bumped it. And the way that he spoke to this woman, oh, my God, he was just like, oh, hello, beautiful, how are you? And he was just like, look at you, that. And he just went to compliment her outfit and this and all this stuff. And she was, like, giddy like a schoolgirl. And when we walked, you know, when he told her, you know, I hope, you know, he looked at who he was with, who she was with, and was like, you get her home safely because all of the ladies need to be taken care of. And then we walked away, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he was like, everybody deserves to feel special. Like, everybody should know that they're beautiful. Like, he genuinely was a good person and meant it, but there was just something about he could convey that. He could convey
right.
that and make
mm-hmm.
you believe, make you very quickly not see him as like, what are you trying to get at me or this, this, and this. And I think
right.
that was his biggest superpower was he could probably get anything out of anybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
All right. So, Sarah, what inspires you to write? Because you also have a blog. What really inspires you to write?
I have a very failed blog. I do much better writing for other people than I do for myself. I don't think I've put
uh-huh.
a blog up for myself in about a year.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So writing is just, it's, I guess you could say it's my coping skill. It's my own personal
mm-hmm.
therapy. It's
mm-hmm.
my way of getting out all of my things as well as trying to find a way to leave an imprint for people who are like me.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So.
And, yeah, and do you ever, you know, do you ever get where you're like, yeah, I don't really feel like writing right now? Or do you ever get, you know, do you ever get where you're like, yeah, I really want to write, and you sit down and there's nothing there?
Yes. All the time.
Okay. And how
all
do you,
the time.
How
but
do you
I do have the benefit that I am back in school for my master's, so I usually have
okay.
to write a paper. I usually have to write about 3 papers a week.
Okay. All right. All right. And
so
and
there
what are you getting your
masters
time,
in? Social work.
Okay. Okay. All right.
And that was another thing that this relationship and book helped inspire was to get back in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college right out of high school and got my degree and got married and started a business with my husband. And
okay.
so now this is kind of like this experience and then writing the book and my friend made me reevaluate what I was doing. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
like the business has been around for a while. I'm not as needed as I was before and I would like to help other people. So
okay.
I went back
Great.
To school. Get my master's.
Okay.
So yes, I there are a lot of papers I have to write, which ironically can inspire me to write different things or can drain me.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, I too am thinking about that master's degree walk.
It's hard.
Right. Uh-huh. It is. It
but,
is when you're considering the work, but definitely it's among consideration. So when I hear people like you that have going back for your master's, it really is an inspiration to do that. And especially
well, my mother
to go
used
into
to tell
a
me.
Field. Huh?
I'm sorry. My phone keeps having the feedback, and I keep accidentally cutting you off. I'm very sorry.
Okay. That's okay. But, you know, so people that want to help other people is really inspiring, but I know it's a tough thing to work in any field where you're helping people. I think it's a very tough field because I think some people get burned out very quickly. Some people have the passion to really be able to go through it. I have a good friend who that's what she does, and I always say to her when I'm, you know, when I hear some stories, I'm always saying, how do you come home at night and not bring that with you?
Right.
So how do you think you're going to manage that?
I think that right now I'm kind of honing my coping skills to,
okay.
you know, to have that there for me. I did work direct care in the field
okay.
when I was, like, younger.
Mm-hmm.
So I do
mm-hmm.
kind of have enough experience to kind of remember what my strengths and weaknesses were. I think the biggest thing is just being very self-aware. Like, you have
mm-hmm.
to constantly be able to check in with yourself of what's the, you know, how are you, what are you being overwhelmed, are you this, are you that, what's the, you know, I remember when I was younger, I had some cases that just hit too close to home that
mm-hmm.
I would be like, or they just hurt too much that I'd have to be like, okay, I can't do this, and let me switch this person with my coworker, and I'll take one of them because I can't handle that, and I think that's the biggest
mm-hmm.
key is being self-aware. Of what you can and
okay.
can't take and when you're getting to a breaking point.
Okay. I have an article that I'm going to love putting in our magazine as another part of your interview today. And for our audience that are listening, we're talking to Sarah Dickinson, and we're talking about her book, Silver Spoons, and we're also talking about, you know, some of her experiences as she was researching for this book. So the book, again, is called Silver Spoons, One Journey Through Addiction, and you can get it in Amazon right now at the paperback or the Kindle version. So I hope you, if you haven't heard our whole program, come back later. You'll be able to hear the whole program, an interview between me and Sarah. So, Sarah, one of the things I want to say is that, you know, in the article you sent was five reasons to change, five reasons we should all consider a change in our relationship. And I want to just say I'm not going to give it away. I really enjoyed it. I really liked the five things. But the one that got me was where you said you can't resolve problems, when you said something your mother told you. The first fight you have with someone you're dating will be the fight throughout your life. And I kind of laughed at that because I was like, wow, that is just so true. So, but when you were writing this, what made you write this article?
Honestly, my daughter. My daughter, okay. And I'm just going to, like, she's probably going to get so upset that I tell this story. So my daughter was a late bloomer for dating. Mm-hmm. She was very, very mm-hmm. much a late bloomer. And she did not, junior, senior year.
Okay.
She finally, like, she meets a boy, she likes him, all this kind of stuff. And they go out, and she, they must have been going out for like two, 3 weeks, not very long. And she was having this health issue. And she was having this, she kept just randomly, she would just, like, get, like, heartburn and then get violently sick for, like, 15 minutes. And then it would go away, and she'd be exhausted. And so she was going through this stuff, and the one doctor was like, oh, it might be GERD. Another doctor was like, she might have a hiatal hernia. She might need surgery. And I was friends with the boy she was dating, his parents. And I came in, and I was on my way out the door, and I'm like, honey, just so you know, you might want to say something to Chris if you have to have surgery. Because, you know, and he doesn't want to hear it from his parents. He would probably want to hear it from his girlfriend. And she just looked at me stone cold and was like, wait a minute. That's not his business. Why would I tell him that? And I'm like, so he doesn't hear it from his parents and get butt hurt. And she was like, so that's what it means to have somebody in your life, to be their girlfriend, is you have to tell them everything? And I was like, well, yeah, kind of. Like, dating is like your best friend that you, like, want to kiss him. I don't think, And she's like, okay.
Right.
And I walk out the door, and I was like, did you talk to Chris? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, did you tell him everything? No. Oh, I broke up with him.
Oh.
What? And I'm just like, what? And she was like, well, you know, I just realize all of this stuff that I have to care about what they think and care about what they do and this. She's like, I ain't got time for that. She's like, do you know how many girls I see in my class that their entire existence is about their boyfriend? Their entire existence is what they're going to do with their boyfriend? She's like, I got goals, and I got plans, and I don't have time for that. And I'm just like, now I'm sitting here, like, so super proud of myself, like, oh, such a good mom. Look, you raised her to be like this. And I was like, well, is he okay? And then she's like, why should I care? And I was like, oh. Maybe you shouldn't be too proud of yourself. And she was just like, realistically, Mom, and this is like my 17-year-old daughter schooling me. She's like, realistically, Mom, we're not responsible for how other people feel. And that's a problem that women – that's a mistake women make. We make ourselves responsible for how other people feel. He's responsible for how he feels. I'm not. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, my kid is scaring me. But she really got me thinking about, like – when you shouldn't be in a relationship and when it's time to get out of or change that relationship. And I was like, so I'm equal parts impressed and terrified by the child that I have raised. So, put that out there.
That's great. That's great. And, you know, the other what I really love about that and love about what she said, though, is that, you know, we lose a lot of I won't say lose in the sense of lose, but I think that a lot of young women you know, everything they're looking at. They meet this boy, and it's like he's everything to them. And, you know, and they forget the goals they have for themselves. And it's always such a critical time. Like I said, she's a late bloomer, but I think it's I'm always teasing my granddaughter. She's 14 now. And we, you know, we have conversations, but I'm always like, you know, I hope she doesn't lose her goals, her ideals of what she wants to do. Because it's very easy, and it's very easy for people to make it seem like, oh, it's okay, when it's not. You know, I mean, it's not okay.
Right.
You know, I'm very proud of my daughter that she waited to get married and have kids when a lot of kids in her, you know, school when she was 15 were getting pregnant. And we had a conversation one time, and she goes, Mom, you know what? She goes, you know all those girls that my friends that were getting pregnant? And I'm like, yeah. She goes, oh, it's scary. They got like 3 and 4 and 5 kids now. And I was like, aren't you glad you just waited? Just, you know.
It sounds like the conversation I had with my mother, because that happened when I was in high school, where like there were girls just getting like left, right, and center. Like there were just girls pregnant, and it like spread like a cold. And my mother was just like, and I was very fortunate because, see, I'm the youngest of 7.
Oh, okay.
And I have over 50 nieces and nephews and another, like, 30 great nieces and nephews. So,
yes.
Like, my mother was just like, this isn't looking attractive to you. And I'm like, oh, no.
Right.
It spreads because they see the attention and the fawning over the pregnant girl. I know what comes after that. Trust me. I'm not having any babies until I'm ready to be called mom. Trust me.
Right.
Like, I was very, like, I was an aunt when I was 3, and I was babysitting when I was, like, 12. I was very, like, I didn't need to go to sex ed classes. I was set.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's been a great interview with you, Sarah. Is there anything you'd like to tell us that might be coming up for events with you? Where more of our audience might want to, you know, clue into that?
Well, you can find me writing a guest article for anybody who will have me. I try to be on the lookout for that, but I'm currently working on a second book that deals with sexism and abuse. Yes. Yes, it's going to be in the same type of vein with letters, except it's going to be written more like diary entries. Yeah, and I've started it. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going to end up, if it's going to be a series of interconnected short stories or not. But I have some characters that are a different demographic of women and a type of abuse that they are dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like a young girl dealing with sexual abuse, an older woman dealing with emotional abuse, kind of thing.
Okay.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been playing demographics of who to represent, because I kind of want to get a very good representation of all types of women, because types of women. It doesn't matter what type of woman you are. It doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't matter what your economic or social background is. If you're a woman, you're dealing with sexism, and odds are if you're a woman, you've dealt with some type of abuse, whether it's unwanted sexual attention from somebody or physical or mental, emotional. So I'm trying to make sure I encompass all different types of women and their reality and their experiences to kind of... So it's definitely a work in progress because I keep changing how I want to do it, but I want it to be just as honest as my other book was. So I've been going through a lot of rewrites.
Definitely, Sarah, when you always keep us in mind when you finish your next book. I would love to have you back on, and I'd love to share your article on our magazine. And actually, you know, we have a our organization has a social enterprise for young girls, and I would like to share this with our young girls in our network, because I'm always looking for I'm always looking for things that are positive to keep them uplifted, but also just tell them, hey, this is the real world, you know, this is the real world, you know. And I know that some parents are not as open as we might be to sit down and have conversations. And I know from my granddaughter, there's so many things that they hold inside and they don't talk about. She'll talk to me about things where she won't talk to her mom. And
right.
But it's also wonderful to, I was talking to her mom yesterday, and she was like, oh, my God, I wish I can just get through adolescence. And I said, you know, and I said to her, look, I said, the key to adolescence is when they're having a little attitude and you know it's not you, just hit them with something that makes them go, huh? And that's it, just walk away.
Right.
So, but at the same time, you know, it's wonderful to see girls when they find their passion and something that they want to follow through. And she's going into music and got her instrument, and just to see her face was just awesome. So
right.
I like to always give this, in, you know, more information to the girls as well as, you know, to parents. Our magazine is about inspiring and uplifting people and giving them the real, you know, the real word, but at the same time, you know, let people know that you can overcome anything. You know, it's a hard mountain, but you still can overcome it, you know. So I definitely will, I'm going to love sharing your book. I'm going to love sharing your article. And so keep in touch when you're writing. We would love to publish what you're putting out there.
Oh, well, you will hear from me incessantly then.
Okay. Well, everyone, thank you for being on our program today. We've had Sarah Dickinson and her book. We've been talking about Silver Spoon, One's Journey Through Addiction. I hope that you'll go pick up the book. I hope you listen to the article so you can learn more about Sarah and her book. And, Sarah, if you were talking to a up-and-coming writer, what would be an advice that you would give to them that you may have learned through your own writing experience?
Right. Every day, write whatever you can, and don't listen to what other people say. Keep going. You're going to hear a lot of no's. You're going to hear a lot of this is not good enough, and you're going to hear a lot of things that break your soul, and you need to just keep writing.
Well, thank you, Sarah, again, for being on our program. We really appreciate your time that you spent. Yes, thank you so much. And, everyone, we are going out today, and I thank you so much for being a part of our program and listening to us interview Sarah Dickinson. And so, everyone, have an awesome day.
Thank you to our faithful listeners. This has been Living Vertical Radio, and you have been listening to our host, C. Steen Duckworth. Stay tuned to our next program. Interested in getting your business in front of a worldwide audience? Contact info@verticalmediagroup.com. That's info@verticalwithak.mediagroup.com for details. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Books that make you laugh. Books that make you scream. Books that make you hope. And books that make you dream. What's on your bookshelf? Discover the books that make you who you are on booksthatmakeyou.com. Read book reviews. Meet the authors who pour their souls into the books you love. And enter to win bookish prizes. If you're a bibliophile, then Books That Make You is your new best friend. Visit booksthatmakeyou.com or find us on Insta and Facebook.